Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host, Dave Marshall, and today you're listening to episode 166, which is the first of a two-part interview on the origins of teeth with Dr. Yara Haraday of the University of Chicago. This is one of the coolest stories that I've seen in paleontology for a while, and so it was one that I absolutely had to indulge myself in and request an interview. And it makes for a wonderful discussion, with plenty of cool facts and surprises that accumulates in one of the most wonderful examples of all of the crazy places that scientific inquiry can lead you. So in the first part of this episode, we're trying to get to grips with what teeth are and what they're used for. Now, if you'd asked me that a few weeks ago, I, like you perhaps, would have said for chewing, right? But here's the thing, we find the earliest teeth before jaws even evolved. In fact, they're not even in the mouth at all, but found on the outside in the external skeletons of jawless fishes. And since these external teeth represent the very first evidence for vertebrates in the whole fossil record, you can get a sense of just how important it is for us to understand what they are, how they evolved, and what they were used for. So in the second part of this interview, coming out in just a few weeks, we discuss what happened when Yara set out to understand some of those questions. And I think it's fair to say that the story got an awful lot more complicated, but in a very exciting way. Naturally, this episode contains a lot of toothy terminology. So if you're not enamored with enamel, and we can't put a dent in your understanding, then you might find yourself on the cusp of comprehension if you visit our website, where we have pictures and diagrams that will help you get to the root of everything odontoed. And for every action you take to share this episode on social media, I pledge to remove a pun from a future introduction. Likes, shares, comments, and subscriptions will all help get the show seen by new audiences, and so is always appreciated. Join us again in a couple of weeks for part two, and until then, I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Yara. Thank you so much for coming on to the show today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Okay, so we always like to start by getting to know you as a person. So I want to know how you got into paleontology. What was your route into the field?
I used to think that my route was pretty unique and indirect, but I've run into a lot of people that have the same path. I'm an immigrant to Canada, and I, like a good Egyptian immigrant, I wanted to go to medical school. And one of the only ways to really get lab experience and more anatomy experience at my university was to volunteer at a vertebrate paleontology lab, if you can believe it. And so I fell in love with the field there, realized that, you know, you could do histology on not just living tissues, but extinct tissues as well. And too many left turns made a right turn. And I ended up doing my master's there. So that's kind of how I got into paleo.
Right. I can't imagine the conversation where you say, yeah, I'm not going down the medical route, going to stick with all this dead stuff.
I kind of did like a bait and switch for a while where I said, you know, it'd be great on a medical application, a master's in science. And you know who's offering me a master's in science for this lab? And all I have to do is work on some dentition. So it was kind of an incremental thing. Oh, it started out as a volunteer opportunity. Then the master's was supposed to be in the path of, you know, making myself a better CV for medical school. And then I quickly dropped that because I didn't want to do any more just non-creative science, I guess. Just medical school stopped appealing to me.
Yeah, I always like that when you're describing like the difference between medical science and medical doctors and academic sciencey doctors and explaining to someone like what the difference between the two are. And I always feel that doing the medical side of it, you're always just like working within a known bounds of stuff. But with the science, you're going off on your own route, and it's creative, the way that you solve problems. And I just couldn't see myself in that latter camp, to be honest.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't creative problem solving within, you know, medical science, but it's just, the reality is, if I kept going down that route, I was going to be a practitioner, and I just didn't want to prescribe the same appointments and hear the same complaints every day and just apply someone else's science. That just wasn't very appealing to me.
Mm-hmm. So outside of science, though, and outside of medicine, what could you see yourself doing?
I mean, I have a big passion for science communication, education, and outreach. So Maybe it's not particularly very outside of science, but I think museum work is so important, and more important now than ever. So I really could see myself doing something along those lines. I also have a big passion for art and exhibit design. So I could see myself working within museums, just outside of the lab and outside of collections, but more of just bringing the information to the people in a more engaging way. I think that is such an interesting field, and watching what does capture people's minds and imaginations and how that does trickle back to science, you know, in a positive feedback loop. So I don't know if that's far enough outside of science to answer your question, but that is definitely a passion of mine.
So anyway, as a paleontologist, how would you sum up your research interests? What is it that you look at?
I guess the way that I would put a big umbrella over my research is I look at the evolution and diversity of mineralized tissue. Invertebrates particularly, but obviously what we're going to talk about today is going to be a little bit of a tangent from that. I would say mineralized tissue evolution and development, because that would encompass all bones, teeth. Recently, I've become kind of a fishy person, or particularly specializing in paleo fish, but that's a recent development. That's just because I'm interested in origins and what did primitive tissues look like, and, you know, fossil fish provide that avenue. But before, I started with teeth of Paleozoic reptiles, some mammals, a little bit of everything.
Because when I think about, you know, like who to speak about a topic, and I think of the topic first. So it's like we'll look at this group or that group, and I think it's very easy to silo people into the different groups of animals or organisms that they look at. But mineralized tissues would cross the whole span of organisms, really.
So I know, right? It's kind of cheating.
How do you find yourself doing that? Is that just like from your route into paleontology, or did you apply to a project where you could, where all of this started? It was just like comparing different mineralized tissues.
I think it kind of happened in two ways. So because, like I said, I was interested in going to medical school, and one of the things that was interesting to me in medicine was pathology and diagnosis. And pathology relies heavily on histology, the study of tissues. So that's kind of one of the parts that I was really interested in the, you know, medical realm, human side. And when I realized that you could do this for extinct animals, that really blew my mind, because I was never like a dino kid. I never really had a dino phase or really knew much about fossils. They're not very popular in the Middle East. It's not a common childhood rite of passage as it is in parts of Europe and North America. So I kind of discovered that really late in life, and just the shape of bones in general, no offense to all the paleontologists that are listening, but wasn't interesting to me as a science on its own. But understanding that you could actually look at like cell spaces and layers of bone and layers of teeth, and from that deduce how they developed and how different that is than modern animals, that had me hooked in an instant. And so through histology, you kind of really only get so many options in deep time, right? You get to cut up teeth or you get to cut up bones. Very rarely do you get to cut up anything that is preserved soft tissue or anything like that, right? So through that, it always kind of ended up being mineralized tissues. And I have a short attention span and a variety of interests. So I kind of just like to grab a bunch of different projects and kind of pick up expertise as you go along. So I picked up some expertise on bone, some on teeth. That's kind of how I created this little niche for myself, I would say.
So teeth is what we are talking about today. So I want to start us all off, so we're all on the same page. And so start with what we know, our own teeth. Can you describe what they are and what they're made of?
Sure. So our own teeth are the only exposed part of our skeleton, which is really kind of a weird thing to think about. Obviously, in humans, we use them for all kinds of things aside from actual chewing. They influence our speech. They influence how we socialize, often social hierarchy. Teeth are really interesting in that way. But of course, you know, they develop inside our jaws. We get two sets in our lifetime. And they're made up of enamel, which is the highest, is the strongest material in the vertebrate body. It is the most crystallized. It has the least organic material and the most mineral content. Then there's dentine, which we'll talk about a lot today. And it's this more, less mineralized and more organic filled mineralized tissue that makes up the bulk of our tooth. And then inside our tooth, there's a pulp cavity, this space that is filled with soft tissue, nerves, and vasculature. And so if you have tooth pain, it's usually because your dentine is exposed and it relays something to your pulp cavity. If you have a root canal, usually they have to go into the pulp cavity. And I think because of how sensitive our teeth tend to be, people are not so excited about going to the dentist. But yeah, generally, that is what our teeth are.
Okay.
I should specify that teeth are the only exposed part of our skeleton, but they're not bone. That's a kind of a common misconception that teeth are bones that we chew with, which isn't the case. They're a completely different type of tissue, potentially deep time related to bone, but we don't know. But they're not bone. They're made up of different tissues.
Okay. And are our teeth representative of all other animals that have teeth at different scales as well? Like, are our teeth typical of mammals? Are they typical of tetrapods, like basically all the ones on land, or even vertebrates with fish as well? They have teeth. Are they all the same? What do they all have in common, or how do they all differ, I guess?
That's a great question. In my opinion, we have like the most boring teeth. So all teeth are basically made up of the same structures. So they have enamel or an amyloid, something very similar. A dentine that makes up the body of the tooth. Usually a pulp cavity, again, the cavity that's inside that has all the vasculature and nerves. But they come in all shapes and sizes. And most animals, I think, are much more creative with their dentition. Also, dentition can have, or teeth in particular, can have all kinds of functions in other animals that they don't have in us. So, for example, even within mammals, which, our modern mammals are notorious for only having the two sets of teeth. We have the baby milk teeth and then our adult set. But even other mammals use them in all different types of ways. So like naked mole rats will like dig with them. Colugos and lemurs will groom with them and have like incisors that are specifically comb shaped and wide so they can groom each other. There's all kinds of secondary functions that mammals have for their teeth that we simply don't. Our teeth are just not very creative looking. Our molars are not very complex compared to other mammals. And then, of course, if you step outside of mammals, you can just throw all the rule books out, right? Because most other animals continuously replace their teeth through their lifetime. And some animals, particularly reptiles, have ontogenetic shifts. They shift their diets between being juveniles and adults, and then their teeth, like their tooth morphology, will also shift. So they'll start out with little pointy peg-like teeth, and then when they become snail eaters as adults, they end up with like big button-looking dentition at the back. Sharks are another great example, right? Continuously replacing their teeth, dumping out whatever they don't need, and putting in new dentition. So dentition is incredibly diverse, and because of that diversity, we can glean a lot of information from teeth. And most people that study teeth don't study them quite like me. Instead, they look at the shape of the dentition, and that will tell you what the animal was eating, potentially tells you a little bit about phylogeny and taxonomy, how they're related to one another. So there's a ton of information in teeth across modern living animals, but also that magnifies in deep time because they tend to fossilize really well.
Yeah, form follows function, so you can tell a lot about how an animal was living and what it was doing based on the teeth. Is there anything in like in the chemistry of them or in the histology of them that differs, like both across the family tree and then also throughout history?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so. So remember we talked about enamel, that top layer that's super mineralized, mm-hmm. that we have and that a bunch of other animals have. So enamel kind of started off its evolutionary journey in early fish as enameloid, this kind of mix between dentine and enamel. It wasn't quite as mineralized. And then through evolution, certain groups got true, what we call quote unquote true enamel, which has just a different crystalline structure. And then within that, even within it being quote unquote true enamel, there's been a bunch of different diversifications. So as you can imagine, if you're a meat eater, if we can oversimplify, if you're a meat eater versus being a herbivore, you have different constraints on your teeth, right? Plants are very fibrous and they tend to have silicates and all kinds of high abrasives. So having really thick and really strong enamel is helpful. And that's evolved multiple times in herbivorous reptiles, in mammals. They actually call prismatic enamel, which is it's structured a little bit differently and is usually thicker to resist wear. So that's always been super interesting. So even within just a single tissue, there's been all kinds of diversity. And then you spoke to, you mentioned the chemistry of teeth. And that's relatively new that people are looking at, but super interesting. The obvious example that everyone likes to bring up is beavers and shrews. So if you ever look at a beaver's teeth, you know, they're incredibly yellow. Why are they so yellow? They tend to have iron included in them to increase the wear resistance because wood is hard. and they only get, you know, the one set, even though it's ever growing, they only get the one set. And then, of course, shrews also have very bright red molars. They have like red on their teeth, and they also include a big amount of iron. So there's all kinds of diversity in the chemical composition, in the ratios of tissues to basically help these animals figure out their particular niches and survive those particular hardships.
Yeah, it sounds incredible that the beavers would have iron in the teeth, but I always have to remind myself that calcium is also a metal, not just, you know, like a milky element that you, it's all soft and white, it is a metal. So the incorporation of metals into our skeletons is something that's actually common.
Yeah, you know, I always forget that too, that calcium is a metal, but it's just so not what we consider, you know, the shiny and like doesn't have as much tensile strength. So we don't think of it biologically that way. But when you tell somebody iron in the teeth, you know, they always look at you like you're kind of crazy.
Right. So understanding where teeth came from, like the origins of teeth, it is a notoriously difficult problem within paleontology. And I just want to get to the root of why. You know, why isn't it as simple as you just find the right fish, you open its mouth, and there are the first teeth? Surely that has to be the way it works, right?
Yeah, if only it was that easy, but maybe then I wouldn't have a job. But basically, the controversy, or I guess the bigger problem, is that teeth didn't start in the mouth, oddly enough. The tissues that we talked about, enamel, dentin, and pulp tissues, they actually all appear outside of the mouth. They appear on these scale-like protrusions called odontodes. And they're still around today in many animals, particularly sharks are a famous example. So, you know, you pet a shark one way, it's soft, it's smooth. You pet it the other way, it's sandpaper. That sandpaper feeling is because it has hundreds of thousands of little toothlets, odontodes, rubbing the wrong way. Catfish are another good example that have odontodes on the outside, these tooth-like structures that cover their body. So we see that in the fossil record as well. Before jaws even existed, there were tooth-like structures outside the mouth that covered our most ancient jawless ancestors. And the general hypothesis is that's where teeth came from. They're made up of the same tissues. They have the same pulp cavities. They develop very similarly. So that's generally the idea. But there's still a whole lot of questions.
It's mind-blowing that, you know, teeth evolved, what would become teeth, evolved before jaws. It just doesn't make sense. But yeah, I guess that's the thing that you've got to get your head around, is that these weren't teeth for chewing. These were teeth for something else. So obviously with sharks and catfish, maybe they had a hydrodynamic purpose. Do we know, or have there been hypotheses as to what these odontodes, or the precursors to teeth, what they were, what function they served in these jawless fishes?
I mean, that is the question, right? So you touched on a couple of the existing hypotheses, like hydrodynamics for one. So I call odontodes kind of teeth without a job, but that's not fair, because they must have had some amount of function, because they're consistently replacing them. They're always, they were diversifying. So like even these early jawless fish, they all have very differently shaped odontodes, ones that look different near their lateral line sensory systems, ones that look different in the front of the head versus the back of the body. So why have all this diversity of morphology if it truly serves no function? Additionally, like making dentin, making these structures is not metabolically cheap. Making mineralized structures and having these, all these, you know, cells that make mineralized structures are quite expensive to upkeep. So they must serve some function. Now, what are those functions? There's been a couple of hypotheses that are floating around, some based in modern fish. So the hydrodynamics hypothesis, so that these odontodes helped these early jawless fish, which didn't have a very, potentially not a very active swimming lifestyle. Some of them didn't even have pectoral fins, right? So maybe these helped them not expend so much energy when they're swimming in the water column. That's one hypothesis based mostly on modern shark odontodes and how they assist with water flow. So that's one. The other is that potentially they were a good way to protect oneself. So again, covering yourself in the hardest tissues that the body can make, that a vertebrate body can make, is probably a good way to make sure that you're not getting eaten by large invertebrates that lived in these ancient seas. And then the final theory is generally that maybe they were part of a sensory structure. And that is based in the fact that our modern dentine and our modern teeth are so sensitive. So those tend to be the three hypotheses that have been floating around as to why particularly jawless fish were covered in these complex odontodes.
Can you explain to us what they look like? So if we look at the modern ones, if we look at a shark, these mm-hmm. odontodes, and let's make sure that we use that term as opposed to teeth, because I think teeth, well, this is me just telling myself and the audience rather than you. Teeth would indicate that it has a function in chewing, mm-hmm. I guess, whereas odontodes can have these other functions. But yeah, when we look at them in sharks, we can't see them with the naked eye. I mean, we can feel them if we rub it the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So are they embedded in the skin? Where were they on these jawless fish? What did they look like, the odontodes? What did jawless fish in general look like, to be honest?
So, I mean, that's a great question. In modern sharks, the odontodes are partially embedded in soft tissue. They basically have this little bony base. They kind of look like little shark teeth most of the time, but they're very diverse. They can be everything from little button shapes to very pointy, like looking like micro teeth, basically, in sharks. But sharks are an oddity in themselves because, of course, they're famously boneless. They've lost most of their bone through evolution. They come from ancestors that had bone, but then secondarily lost it. So they make a really poor comparator sometimes to early jawless fish. So what do early jawless vertebrates look like? I like to kind of explain it to people as a handheld vacuum with googly eyes on the front of it. It's really hard for people to think of an organism that is swimming through the sea with no jaws. They kind of assume that means also no mouth, but that's not entirely true. They had like a pretty open slit-like mouth, kind of like your handheld vacuum, and often the eyes are in the front end. So they're odd little creatures. And their odontos are fused onto parts of their dermal armor. So they have this bony armor that covers their entire body, sometimes in big plates, sometimes in small scales, but almost always covered in odontodes. So enamoid, dentine. And they can look very different depending on what species you're looking at. Some species have little star-shaped odontodes. Some have little button-shaped ones. Some have like elongate tubes of dentine and enamel that cover their entire body. So they're quite diverse, but what unites them is what they're made of.
Okay. Are they attached superficially or part of the dermal armor?
I would consider them part of it because they're attached. They're definitely attached to the bony scales. But we still have to assume that all of that is embedded in a soft tissue, which I think was one of your other questions. Is it embedded in a soft tissue? Is it covered in a soft tissue? And it definitely had to have been because there is lateral lines that go through this dermal armor. There is vasculature that goes right up to it. And the armor itself grows. And what we know about bones and teeth is that they need to grow or to develop. They need their soft tissue, right? They need the vascularization. They need space within soft tissue that cells can move around in and actually make these structures. So all of this would have had to be embedded in an envelope of soft tissue.
Okay, so it would be like all the organs, all the stuff on the inside, muscle and whatnot, then an external layer of bone, and then mm-hmm. like a thin skin.
Yeah.
Is that too different kind of like my skull right now?
Yeah, exactly. Basically, so if you touch your forehead, you can still feel the bone right under it, right? We have a very thin layer of skin over our cranium, and our cranium is also dermal bone. So that's actually a perfect comparison because that's kind of how that would work for them. So you assume that the odontodes are big enough that they're slightly poking up above the layer of soft tissue, probably providing either some armor, but maybe not all of the different species had it actually exposed over the soft tissue. We're not sure, but soft tissue definitely had to exist for those structures to continue growing.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, like, with the suggested purposes that we went through, protection, hydrodynamics, the other one that I forgot, sensory stuff. Like, if it's covered in a thin layer of skin, those are kind of redundant, because a skin layer could have the sensory. It could be innervated, and you could feel through that rather than, like, a mineralized tissue. If you have skin over the thing that's protecting your protecting you, then your skin is gonna like get abraded off before the bone is, and then with hydrodynamics it's covered. Like it kind of seems like it'd be redundant unless they kind of poked through.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, except the protection part. I mean, a lot of animals will embed osteoderms in soft tissue, and it still provides enough protection that you don't get crunched in half, but rather just have like a scrape. But yeah, definitely. And that's, again, one of the reasons why we think that it had to have been poking out of the soft tissue to some extent. I mean, it's similar to modern sharks, right? They're made in the soft tissue and then kind of erupt the same way that our teeth and our mouth do. They erupt through the soft tissue, or they're made in the jaw or in the soft tissue, and then they come out to actually perform their function.
Okay, and were they pretty small as well? The way that I think of it when I look at them is, if you ever have had a pack of tablets and they come in those blister packs with the foil, they're just kind of like raised bumps on a flat sheet. Is that what they all look like?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty accurate, except, like I said, some of them are so weird and tubular. So like it's kind of a row, almost like a farmer raking field, and there's just rows of these odontos. They're connected across the body. And those are particular adaptations that people think maybe are for sensory systems or for vascularizing things in a certain way or for hydrodynamics, because if you have rows along the body, maybe that helps funnel water in a certain direction. But again, very hard to ask very dead fish these questions.
Well, this is why we're asking you this kind of stuff. You're the one that needs to have the answers for us today. And did this exoskeleton cover the whole of the animal?
So in most jawless fish, they're armored all over. But this is, of course, strongly hindered by the fact that we don't have a whole lot of articulated early jawless fish. And this is one of the areas that I'm really interested in, so I'll touch on this now. But one of the things that I'm very interested in with invertebrates is, how do you go from no bone squishy boy in the Cambrian to a fully armored handheld vacuum looking thing that is relatively large in the Middle Ordovician? And there seems to really not be any transitionary fossils or anything that looks like it has, like, what does half a skeleton look like, I guess is the question, if I can modify it from what good is half a wing. What good is half a skeleton, and what does the evolution of early bone look like? We really don't know, and that's one of the things I'm looking for. And worse yet, we don't know if we would recognize it if we saw it, right? Maybe they disarticulate really quickly and we just find fragments. Maybe that didn't cover the whole body at the very beginning. So at the very beginning, it's really hard to tell. We only have a couple of articulated jawless fish friends in the base of the tree. Later on, they seem to be quite armored until later placoderms, where they start to lose some of it. And then, of course, you know, pre-sharks famously lose a ton of it. But most of the time, yeah, they're armored from tip of nose to end of tail, covered in bone and pre-teeth odontodes.
Did they also have an internal skeleton as well?
So, yes. In that it's probably cartilaginous, but did it have any biomineralization? Kind of unlikely. There is new research by folks in Birmingham, actually, that found a whole bunch of endocranial mineralized cartilages in some of the earliest vertebrate, with armor, this thing called Erypticius. It's a really cool paper where they basically looked at the mineralized structures that held the brain. But we still don't fully know if that mineralization is primary or secondary, as in, was it taphonomic that it had that kind of mineralized cartilage? Or is it actually primary that animal really did mineralize the inside of its brain capsule? And the reason that's kind of a mystery is because everything after this animal, so everything after Erypticius, other jawless fish don't seem to mineralize everything around there. So it's we need more data. Generally, I would say they have a cartilaginous skeleton. Some seem to have mineralized that cartilaginous skeleton, but it's not true bone inside.
Right. Okay.
It's
incredibly complicated. And it's one thing that, you know, like as someone who works on giant arthropods from this time, it's very easy because, you know, you just, they have their exoskeletons and that's it. You know, they just exist. There's little differences between each of the different groups. But when you're looking at the vertebrate one and you're like, okay, is this bone? Is that bone? What even is bone? Like, here's sort of bone in this place, but not that place. I just would like a very easy stepwise change from one thing with kind of like a cartilaginous skeleton to a bony skeleton, and that would be so easy. Do we have that for these odontodes going from the exoskeleton to the mouth, or do they just appear one day as when jaws evolved and it's just like, oh wait, here's the teeth, they've moved there now? Are they even the same thing, which is this like concept of homology? Like, how do we know that odontodes and teeth are exactly the same thing, as opposed to two different things that are kind of like formed in the same way or out of the same material?
So I'll answer your last question first, which is, how do we know that they're the same thing? This question of homology, right? I mean, just because it walks like a duck doesn't actually necessarily mean it's a duck. So in that case, we're very lucky in that modern sharks have both odontodes and teeth, and we can actually test what genes are activated when they're producing one versus the other. And interestingly, it's pretty much the exact same gene set, just expressed in a different location. This has also been recently done in catfish. So catfish that have odontodes on the outside and their teeth on the inside. If you mark the genes that are supposed to make teeth, they glow on both things. They glow, or they indicate at the external odontodes, and they also indicate at the teeth in the mouth. And therefore, that is a really good line of evidence that, hey, if you're using the same toolbox, the same genetic sequences to make one and the other, it's very likely that they have a common ancestor.
Oh, that's awesome. But is that also reflected in the fossil record, or does it just appear one day?
Exactly. Where is the transition from external odontodes, right, that cover the body, versus teeth in the mouth? And we have fish that are basically covered in teeth, covered in odontodes all the way to the margins of the mouth. So this is after, you know, once jaws evolve, we have things that are basically have odontodes all the way to the edge of the mouth. And then the morphology of these odontodes change and kind of grade into the mouth area. They're pointier around the edges of the mouth. And this is a whole area of contention. There's labs that absolutely hate each other just based on this, because it's really hard, right? It quickly becomes semantics in that, well, do you call this thing a tooth or do you call this thing an odontode? Well, it's on the margin of the mouth and it's pointy and it looks different. Well, does that make it a tooth or not? Oh, well, it doesn't replace, so it's not a tooth. But maybe there's teeth that don't replace, you know? So it becomes very difficult because in many ways, having a more complete fossil record gives us that gradation and experimentation that happened in evolution, right? And it's very unlikely that we captured that one particular animal that is the ancestor of the transition, but likely at this time period, there was all kinds of experimentation and diversity that was happening. And it shows that multiple lineages were really trying to, well, get pointy things in their cool new jaws, because that makes you a better predator. So who did it first and how did it happen? There's generally two ideas as to how how odontodes became teeth, or how basically teeth came to be. And one is the general gradation of odontodes to the outside of the mouth and then slightly to the inside margin of the mouth. And then, you know, that made a better predator. And that one was selected for because it had bigger meals, for example, or, you know, was just a better predator. Or the other option is the genetic the genetic pathway that makes odontodes maybe randomly became expressed in the new jaws. And that also became a good way to become a predator. And then that one was selected for. And that would explain again why we have like these bursts of diversity. And all of a sudden we have a bunch of things that are basically placoderms and early ostichthyans that have full teeth in the mouth. We don't really have their predecessors exactly. So there's a lot of diversification that happened at the base of what is a tooth and what isn't a tooth. There's kind of that gradation. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if multiple things happened in different lineages and we're just seeing a very weirdly pruned tree that is A, modern, and then B, biased by the fossil record, if that helps, if that makes sense.
Yes. So all of this is just the context for looking for the first teeth. this is incredible. The amount of complexity, the number of people who are working on all of this. And so what then is the oldest evidence for odontodes or for dentine or for any sort of toothy stuff?
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupshire, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content. And thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.